session number 28776, Reel 3.
Admiral Sir Raymond Lygo, Reel 3. Admiral, after you'd completed the course at Sealand, what was the next move?
Well, the next move was to glorify in the fact that you'd passed the course. You now were, thinking yourself very clever indeed. And you then had to go to the next step was to Canada, to go to Kingston, Ontario, to go to what was then, I think it was called Advanced Flying School or something, as opposed to Elementary Flying School. And so you had to then, you were sent on leave, you had a couple of weeks leave, we had to join, I think, up in Liverpool in, I think we were at, where's that, what's the famous holiday resort?
Blackpool.
We were sent to Blackpool and put into somebody's boarding house, I'm sure, to wait to be called forward to go on a ship to America. And I went on the Queen Mary or the Queen Elizabeth, one or the other. And so then we waited and kicked our heels around there. And then, right, report to the RTO office at Liverpool at such and such a time. And then you bag an hammock and you put aboard the Queen into a cabin which had like three tier bunks, as I recall. So you were in a bunk and there. And off you went. And it was, of course, a fantastic experience for somebody who'd never done anything like that before. First of all, the food. We came out of rationing and suddenly there was food for everybody. I mean, lots of food because they used to store up in America. And chocolate. There was chocolate. Oh, I remember Hershey bars. I mean, they couldn't believe it. You made yourself sick with bloody chocolate. And that's what it was, meals, three meals a day or two meals a day, whatever it was, and wandering around and looking at the grey ocean as this the great ship ploughed its way along. And I remember, and then of course there were always the kind of illegal activities. Crown and Anchor was the one, and there was always a Crown and Anchor school going. These were usually the ship's crew who would absolutely milk all these chaps who really didn't know what they were doing. And I never played, because I'm not a gambling man. I was always too afraid to spend my money on gambling. And so that was really it. It was lying on your bunk or eating or wandering around the deck. And then we arrived in our case, in Halifax. No, we didn't. We arrived in New York. And then had to get on a train to go up to Halifax. So that's where we went, a long journey. And that was fascinating because the trains in those days, I mean, with such long journeys, I mean, that was fascinating. And got to Halifax and then to Moncton, New Brunswick, which was a big holding depot for all kinds of people. And there we were held, waiting and pending, going down to Kingston. And then we were put on a train to go down to Kingston, and I know that in Stan Brandt's little booklet he's got pictures of me and some others there in Moncton, New Brunswick, being entertained by some very nice Canadian people. And then on the train down to Kingston, and in his book I see he's got that episode, it's in my book, of Montreal, where the train stopped and was going to be a two-hour break. And we said to Lieutenant... his name's gone, who was the officer in charge of records, can we go off and have a look at... And he said, yes, as long as you're back here, by sir. So the four of us, and Brandt being one, I've got a feeling it was... doesn't matter, two others. And we said, there was a taxi ring. We said, could you take us for a tour of Moncton? And he said, well, boys, he said, we're not allowed to do that with fuel rationing. You can't do that. So you can't go around taking pictures of the too obviously. As we got inspired, you drove off. We stopped outside this house. I thought, well, why are we stopping here? And he said, right, you can all get out here and go into this. And we did like a lot of bloody lambs, you know. We got up, went up these steps, had another one, and went into this living room, sat there, and didn't realise it. We were in a knocking shop. We were actually in a whorehouse. And so we sat there, and these girls appeared. I've never forgotten it, and we never knew whether it was the night shift coming off or the day shift going on. They all had kind of napkins they held and raised them up and lowered them down. And we sat there staring at this. And then, to my horror, all my companions fled. They'd gone out the front. I was left sitting there. And the madam said to me, don't you know your own mind? I remember that. She said, don't you know your own mind? And I said, yes. I said, I know my mind, but the taxi driver doesn't. And so then I departed. And, of course, we then drove around a bit of Montreal and took some pictures through the windows of the cab and got on, because it was a great story to go back and tell our companions. Well, of course, chaps, I mean, we've all been into a brothel and they couldn't believe it, you see. It was absolutely true. We hadn't done anything, but we weren't going to let on. Anyway, so that was Montreal. Those long journeys in those extraordinary trains down through from New Brunswick down to Montreal, then from Montreal down to Kingston, and arrived in Kingston, and then were of course settled into our new accommodation there, which was infinitely superior to anything else that we had had up to then. And of course it was luxurious food as far as we were concerned. And started flying the Harvard, which everyone thought was an amazing experience, you know, this great sophisticated aeroplane and all the rest of it. And so it was a question of mastering that, and then going, I think the course was divided into two parts, advanced flying training and then something else, service flying training or some such thing. And at the end of that, we got our wings, which we wore our sleeve, can you believe it? And we're then qualified. We'd done the course and we had our wings. While we were there, we bought a car between us, a group of us. I bought it, can you believe it? I think it was called a Studebaker Erskine, which was a very kind of upright motor car, had no brakes, and God almighty. But anyway, we enjoyed ourselves. Thank goodness. I mean, I never drank. I'd been brought up in a fairly kind of Presbyterian household, and so I never drank. And so a lot of my companions, of course, drank, but I didn't. Which was my saving during the war, I suppose. But then, with all those little adventures that. In that motor car and all the other things, and then finally graduating and getting our wings, and that was it. And then I discovered that I had been put down. I didn't know at the time. I got an above average or something, because I had to be good at aerobatic. And so this is my instructor was an RAF chap who was a frustrated fighter pilot, and so he wanted me to become a fighter pilot. And so, unbeknownst to me, I was recommended to be a fighter pilot. So, we came back we came back on the Aquitania from Halifax.
Could I just ask a little bit before that? Obviously, as you gave me a picture of the Tiger Moth.
Yes, ma'am. All right. Yes, the Harvard was, of course, a low-wing monoplane, as opposed to the biplane we had been flying. It had a variable pitch propeller, which is, you know, something very exotic, and it had a mixture control. It was a much more complicated, but a very good basic training aeroplane. It was a tail drag, in as much as the Tiger Moth had had a skid at the back. It didn't have a wheel at the back, so the skid kept you fairly straight, and that was one of the difficulties of turning. When you put on full rudder in a Tiger Moth, the skid turned with the rudder. With the Harvard, you had a tail wheel. And, of course, it was a lockable tail wheel. If you didn't lock it and you landed. Where am I going to have that? Over there. Thank you very much, Linda. So I'm drying up. if you did lock it, then there was a great danger that you would, what was it called? You would swing on landing. You would do a ground loop. The airplane would ground loop. So you, but if it was locked, then it would, generally speaking, hold you fairly straight. But it was a more difficult aircraft to land because of that. It was much more powerful, of course, had a much greater range of instruments, I mean, than you had in the Tiger Moth. It, altogether, a much more sophisticated airplane. It was reasonably fast, I suppose, 160, 100 something knots. And but again, it was fully aerobatic, fully spinnable. You could do all the things in it that you had been taught to do in the Tiger Moth, but in a more, and of course it had a closed cockpit, thank goodness, so you didn't have to suffer the indignity of being frozen. But and so it was, that was good. I found it a delightful aeroplane to fly. I had no problem with it. It had flaps, full flaps, at the trailing edge of the wing, so that you had the experience of normally you landed with the flaps down, but you could do a flapless landing if you wanted to, or if they failed for some reason. What else did it have that was different, more powerful? So there was torque on the engine. So the first time you met torque, in other words, if you opened up the throttle too fast, then the airplane would tend to turn under the effect of torque coming onto the propeller. It had a variable pitch propeller, so you had that to adjust from, I think it was like 2,400, 2,600 revs on takeoff to back to about 1,800 for normal cruising or 2,000. So you had that to play with. It was a more complicated aeroplane, but it was a very nice aeroplane. There was nothing particularly difficult about it. It's interesting, of course, with the Harvard. Stayed as a trainer for many years. When I, after the war, when I became a flying instructor and was then asked by the RAF to go as an instructor on in the Central Flying School, instructing instructors, then we had Harvards, the same aeroplane that I'd trained on. So it lasted a very long time. And it was a very sound, it was and a very good aeroplane. Anyway, but on the time at Kingston, it was a question of mastering it, mastering all the difficult, more difficult things, because you could go on much longer navigational training exercises, which we did. We had a satellite airfield, as I recall, at Gananoque, where we would go and shoot, practice false landings and precautionary landings, rather than clutter up the main airfield at Kingston.
With the pattern to your training, were you left more to your own devices?
You had more solo time than you had, probably a little more solo time than you had on the Tiger Moth. So you were on your own a lot more. And the other thing you did there, of course, was formation flying, which you hadn't done before. Formation, not formation aerobatics, but just straight formation flying, straight and level. Of course, you had simulated, you could simulate gunnery runs, air-to-air gunnery against a towed target. You could simulate air-to-ground attacks, so firing guns at targets on the ground. So you could do all those kind of things which you hadn't done before. So there's a much bigger variety of things that you could do.
With the formation flying, again, to a layman, it looks quite a difficult thing. Is it difficult, or are there things that you have to remember while formation flying?
It's not difficult. If it was difficult, I wouldn't be able to do it. It's not difficult. What you've got to judge is how close you can come, or how close you shouldn't come, to the other aircraft. And the other thing, of course, is to remember that in a turn, if you're on the inside of the turn, then you've got to throttle back fairly early. because, you know, otherwise you'll come out of formation. If you're on the outside of the turn, you've got to put throttle on to stay in position. And it sometimes gets a little bit confusing. If you're in a banked turn, you suddenly find yourself looking up at the other aircraft. And of course, you mustn't spend too much time doing that, or the tendency will be to close on it. So you've got to really keep your eyes straight ahead and just every now and again make sure that you're in the right position. So that was something different and something interesting to do.
How close would you fly to the other aircraft?
Well, at that stage, you wouldn't have the wing tucked in behind the other wing. You would have the wing clear, so that if anything went wrong, you could overshoot and it wouldn't matter. But that made it more difficult in a turn, because the further out you are, as you can see, the more you'd have to throttle back, because the turn, you know, and on the outside, the more throttle you need. Joining up is another interesting thing, because if you are told to join an aircraft that's already airborne, you've got to find it, and then you've got to climb up, and then you'll overtake it. And then the common error is to overshoot, of course, when you get closer to it, because you're going too fast and you shoot past it. So all those things need to be, and were, practiced. And, you know, so you became pretty adept and versatile in flying the aeroplane. There was also instrument flying to be done, which hadn't been done in the Tiger Moth. So, like in Kingston, it was always clear you didn't have much bad weather to bother you, so you'd have to go instead of flying in the front of the aeroplane, you'd be put in the back with your instructor up in front, and you'd have a hood to put over the top of you to simulate instrument flying. So there was quite a bit of instrument flying to do, simulated instrument flying.
And I take it with that that you have to fully trust your instruments.
Oh yes, I mean the great thing there to get through to the student was you must not think about what your head is telling you. You must concentrate on the instruments, the artificial horizon, which is the key instrument. But then, of course, you had to try flying on basic instruments where the artificial horizon would be blanked out. So then you'd have to try to fly just on the altimeter, the airspeed indicator, and the turn and bank indicator. And that you could do. And indeed, when you came to pass your instrument rating tests, then you had to do quite a bit of it on basic, what's called basic instruments.
Is it an easy process when you start, at that stage of your flying career, to fully trust your instruments in your own mind?
I think it depended very much on the individual. I mean, I always enjoyed instrument flying and found no difficulty flying on instruments, which was fortunate, because otherwise I don't think I'd have survived. But I think some people may have had difficulty with it. I'm sure they must have. But I, as far as I was concerned, it was something I quite enjoyed. It's very demanding and a bit stressful, but, you know, it was something I could do.
You mentioned as well that you have to trust the instruments because of they are telling you what's happening. In an aircraft, can you get a sensation in an aircraft, almost like the idea of flying by the seat of your pants, where you're not actually in the position that you are, the aircraft is in?
Yes, I mean, you can, if you allow yourself to. Supposing you were flying along and you suddenly found yourself in cloud, as you might today, then I have to tell you that your own ability to determine whether you're up the right way or not up the right way is very limited. You would very quickly, without visual reference, which is what we have on the ground, you would very quickly find that you didn't know whether you were level in flight, with your wings level, or whether in fact you were in a turn. You might think you were in a turn when you weren't, or not in a turn. The sensations that the brain would get from being completely divorced from any visual reference outside means that it would very quickly get disorientated. So the feelings that you can sometimes get of being in a turn, you look at the instrument, you're not, you're straight and level. your brain is telling you, I think we're turning, you're not. And there the danger is that you begin to allow the sensations which your brain is giving you to defeat what the instruments are telling you. And the instruments are right. They're never wrong. And therefore you must, in instrument flying, learn to rely totally on the instruments. And with an artificial horizon, it's not difficult because it's such a simple instrument. Without it, it is difficult because the only way you can tell whether your wings are level is from the top needle of the turner bank. And that, of course, can be affected by rudder, can cause it to move, and that would make you think it was doing something, or you were doing something, which actually wasn't. One of the things about all flying, without, in a reasonable aeroplane, to remember is, and I've told my students this many times, remember this aeroplane can fly itself better than you can fly it. So if you've got it properly trimmed, and by that I mean it hasn't, you haven't allowed it to have artificial forces acting on it because you have got the wrong trim on the rudder or the wrong trim on the elevator, but it nicely trims so that it'll sit flying a straight level without you touching it, then remember that is better. Normally it would like to do that. It wouldn't like to find itself in some funny position crashing into the ground. That's not what it would like to do.
And I take it as part of the course at that stage you were also doing night flying. Is there anything to know about?
Yes, you're quite right. Night flying was another. I don't think we did any night flying in the Tiger Moth, but perhaps we did. Isn't it terrible? I have to look at my logbook. Because in those days, of course, you'd have used flares, gas flares along the runway. I think we did do some of that, or must have done. And in the Harvard, yes, we certainly did, and this was, just another form of flying. It's something you've got to get used to. On a clear day, with lots of lights around, to enable you to judge whether you're upside down or flying straight and level, it's not too difficult. The instruments are there to tell you. So you want to keep a close eye on them all the time, even though you're flying with your head out of the cockpit, not in it. You've still got to keep an eye on the instruments all the time to make sure it's all right, and then you'll get used to the lights that you find on the ground. I mean, there are lots of horrific stories of chaps trying to land on the main street at Hamilton rather than back at the airport, but I find that difficult to believe. Because usually the airfield was some distance out of town in those days and with not all that many lights around it. So the runway lights and the beacon, which in those days they used to have at airfields, a flashing beacon which would be flashing the letters of the airfield, so you knew what it was. So you could soon orientate yourself with the runway. And of course, in those days, those early days, we didn't have glide path indicators. Today, of course, every runway has a glide path indicator. So you come in with two greens, two reds would be perfect approach. But greens being too high, reds being too low. But you didn't have those. You had to judge it yourself by eye to get the perspective of what the runway was looking like in order to make your approach properly. And that was a question of judgment and a question of experience, training, really.
You also mentioned one of your instructors who was keen for you to be a fighter pilot. How did you practice the kind of mock attacks at that stage as well?
Well, you were doing mock attacks on other aeroplanes, learning standing sort of fairly high on the side of the aircraft that was your target, and then peeling over towards it and coming around on what was known as a curve of pursuit, so that you would pull the gun sight through that aeroplane to so that your bullets, if they were fired, would actually, in theory, hit it. And that was the kind of thing you did. And of course, aerobatics was the other thing, I think, mainly. I think the reason he put me down as a fighter pilot was purely because I was capable or competent at doing aerobatics. And he thought, well, that's, he obviously ought to be a fighter pilot. Which, in fact, I didn't want to be, because all my friends were going, were going off to fly barracudas and swordfish, and here's LIGO going off to fly Seafires in the Navy, which is the Naval Spitfire. But that came at a later stage.
And how did the ground instruction while you were in Canada differ from the ground instruction that you'd had while you were in the UK? Was it more advanced?
Much more advanced. A great deal more a theory of flight, a lot of which was not really as accurate as it should be. Remember that the theory of flight, there was one chap, Air Commodore Kermode, who wrote a book on the theory of flight, and that was the standard manual. And I was more or less brought up to read his book at a later stage, not at this stage. But there was still a lot of kind of fairly ad hoc ideas of how aeroplanes really worked and why. And so some of the instruction was perhaps not as good as it should have been, but then that was because of ignorance, really, of the time, rather than a deliberate attempt to confuse you. We had to learn a lot more about the engine and how it operated and the dangers of carburetor icing and that kind of thing, the importance of oil pressure and the way the engine worked and how the oil was circulated around the engine. We had to learn a lot about the propeller and the importance of and how a constant speed propeller worked. And when you say constant speed, it means that propeller will hold the angle of the blade that you've set. So you set it by the revs that you've set on the rev control, and it will hold that. And if you want fine, you can put it into fine, and you have to understand what is fine pitch. What does the blade of the blades do at that particular time? The importance of icing on the propeller and flying in weather where you like get icing on the aircraft and certainly on the propeller, flight in icing conditions. You needed to know a lot more about the standard 303 gun that was fired and the 20mm and how that operated and how many rounds it had and how the belts were fed of the ammunition into the gun, so as you understood how it fired. I think we used to do bombing with little smoky bombs, and bombs that were like made a patch of flour, and you learn how to do dive bombing or glide bombing, and what was important that you got within the circle of where the bomb was supposed to go. We didn't practice rocket firing because we didn't have any rockets at that time, but would have been something that came later. So there was a great deal to be done. I think whether we had started on the psychology of flight, I'm not sure. It became a great big thing. It is a great big thing right now. And of course, and like a lot of these things, if you're not careful, it finishes up with a lot of mumbo jumbo. But this was about the effect flight would have on you. It is an exhausting thing to start with, to go off in those days or any day and do an hour's intensive flight and come back and land. Then you were fairly tired, and they used to say it was equivalent to 8 hours labour in the field or something, the exhaustion that you suffered. So when you think about some of these chaps during the Battle of Britain who were flying 3 and 4 and 5 sorties a day, then you can begin to see the kind of pressure that came on them, and to learn about the medical facts that affected you, particularly with regard to oxygen and pressurization, or the lack of oxygen, and how to recognize, to go into a decompressor chamber to learn what were the effects of, you see me automatically looking at my nails as I'm talking to you, because one of the first things that happens is the whites of your nails starts to increase, so you go, oh, hello, I'm beginning to become a bit inoxic. In fact, it happened to me not so very long ago. And I automatically started looking at my fingers. So there was a great deal that one had to learn as you became more accustomed to flying more advanced aircraft.